sometimes you need an independent review of a company to really understand what is going on. They had done a great job managing and growing the business over decades. They just ran into a problem and they literally could not see the forest for the trees. And we're able to help the company identify the problem and then solve the problem.
Welcome to the CEO Coaching International podcast. What we do on this show is we find the world's leading entrepreneurs and CEOs, and we spend about a half hour with them and really dig into their story. We want to understand the strategies and the tips and the tools that they use to make big happen in their business. And by the end of each episode, you'll have actionable ideas that you can implement on your path to big success. To learn more about CEO Coaching International and how we can help you dramatically grow your business, visit us at CEOCoachingInternational.com. Hello and welcome to the CEO Coaching International podcast. I'm your host, Steve Sandusky. My guest today is Dan Kim. Dan is the VP of Product Development and Content at CEO Coaching International. He oversees the creation of the Making Big Happen tools, methodologies, and skills. He also serves as a resource to coaches and clients for challenges related to finance, banking, M&A, private equity, venture capital, IPOs, industry benchmarks, and reporting issues. In our conversation, we delve into the power of real-time financial models for strategic decision-making, and we discuss the critical role of accurate financial data. We explore comprehensive forecasting models, and he shares real-world examples of how this level of financial data can make a big impact on your company. And make sure you listen to the end as Dan shares a personal story about money, greed, and the unraveling of a company culture. With that, please enjoy my conversation with Dan Kim. We both know that most folks who are starting businesses or CEOs of businesses don't necessarily feel like the financial side is what they're super passionate about, but yet we know how critically important it is to really understand the financial side of the business and have the information at your fingertips and be able to draw important insights from that. So why don't you set some context for us here about how entrepreneurs and CEOs and CFOs should really be thinking about the financial side of the business?
Now, I've spent a career 25 years in investment banking. And the very first thing that I learned to turn to as an analyst when I'm looking at a company are the numbers. As we know, the numbers never lie and people do. And by that, I'm not implying that people are liars, but we do need to take company statements with a grain of salt. Intentional or not, statements may be misleading or unrealistic. And it's our job to analyze the numbers to determine reality. So the first thing I do whenever I look at a company is I review their financial statements, historical and forecasted if they have it, to get a really good sense of where they are, where they're going, the type of margin profiles, does it fit the industry that they're working in? Does it make sense in terms of where they expect growth forecast relative to competitors or what's going on in the broader market? So to me, it is always the numbers that really provide the foundation for any type of analysis for a company. And in my view, without a really solid handle on the numbers to begin with, it's nearly impossible from my perspective to be able to do a proper analysis, to go in depth with any type of management team, or to really fully understand a business model. Our intent here is to help companies with their financial planning so we can get that kind of clarity.
So tell me about the different types of models that firms should be looking at, should be developing, should be using. And are these models the same for every business, or do these models need to be personalized for a particular business?
The more I work with companies, the more I realize that there's really no uniformity and there's no consistency across the board. So what we've developed are a number of templates to help provide some standardization of how you present the data. Of course, the income statement, balance sheet, and cash flow are common across the board. But how you integrate those statements is another matter in terms of forecasting capabilities. So we've built out templates that build these templates out of first principles. So you can put in your revenue drivers, drive your margin assumptions, which ultimately drive your cash flow statement and your balance sheet. And you're now capable of forecasting out one quarter by month, a number of years, what have you. And you could determine where your company is going based on historical numbers and your future assumptions. And this really helps drive strategic decisions for what the company is headed, their cash use, should they invest in current products or invest in new products, et cetera. And we have a multitude of templates to help companies not only look at their financial statements and ratios and KPIs and leading and lagging indicators, but one of the things that has become probably most used in terms of demand from the companies that we work with is a simple valuation. By that, what I mean is a lot of private companies, even though they've been operating for some time, have never really thought about what the value of their company is because they've never had to access external capital. And oftentimes they come to us and they say, our company is worth X today, we believe, and we want 10X in 5 years. So not knowing where they are today, it's impossible to determine how we can get 10X going forward. We have templates and procedures, and we customize all of them for each of our companies. And one of the most useful ones has been discounted cash flow, where we take the profit and loss statement of the company. We make a number of assumptions. We work with the management team to build a forecast for the next 5 years. And we forecast the company's free cash flow. And we can show the sensitivity in terms of a number of ranges between our assumptions for growth, our assumptions on margins, our assumptions on working capital use, et cetera. And that drives the value for the company with a matrix. And we can really now get a sense of what the management team needs to do in order to both run the business today and how to invest for the future.
In recent decades, I would say, we now have all kinds of adjusted financial statements. We have adjusted EPS. We have adjusted cash flow. And so we're taking out a bunch of different stuff to make a company look as promising as possible. And I'm thinking perhaps some of the startup companies or some of the publicly traded companies. Tell me a little bit about how you view those things when people make these adjustments and try and make their company look better for Wall Street, for example, and how that might factor into a discounted cash flow valuation. How do you reconcile making all these adjustments versus, hey, the numbers don't lie, people do?
We take those adjustments with a grain of salt as well. Oftentimes, you'll see management teams take a little bit of advantage of that because EBITDA, as an example, is not a standard GAAP approved number. So EBITDA is one of the most popular ways and most common ways to value almost any company in any industry. And so we have to take a hard look at the add back, so to speak, and to determine a real fair value for the company, because sometimes they may or may not be appropriate. And we balance those valuation techniques with a number of other methodologies to really provide a balance. EBITDA multiples is one thing. We can look at revenue multiples that are more appropriate for companies with high recurring revenue, for example, in the software space. We'll look at discounted cash flow models that go out multiple years. We'll look at peer analysis. We'll look at who your closest competitors are in both the public and the private worlds to determine appropriate value. We'll look at precedent transactions for takeouts. So there are a multitude of factors to balance out that one metric in terms of adjusted EBITDA numbers. And if you take all those in average, then you start to derive a fair value for a company.
When you talk about a financial model, I'm assuming you're not talking about QuickBooks. So QuickBooks can get us some information. And obviously there's other software systems out there that are your accounting systems that you can use. But give me a little detail, if you can, on when you say financial model, are we talking an Excel spreadsheet? Are we talking something customized that you've created? Or what does that actually mean?
Yeah, my preference is to work in Excel. Of course, most companies that we've at least worked with operate using QuickBooks, which is easily imported into Excel. And what we find is Excel just provides you significantly greater flexibility to take those numbers, manipulate the numbers, forecast the numbers, build models, build charts, build KPIs, and really have a much better ability to take what are really simplistic numbers with really not a lot of analytical capabilities built into QuickBooks and enhance that now through Excel. And every single company I've ever worked with in the past uses Excel as well. So it makes it easier to both work with them and work with myself because all of our templates that we've built out, at least from the financial side, are in Excel because it provides the greatest flexibility.
Oftentimes, the leader of a company does not rise to the top through the financial side of the business. And so that is not necessarily their natural area. In your experience, what is the relationship between the CEO and the CFO or the top financial person in the organization?
That's a great question. And I've seen hundreds of companies over my career. And generally, when I've met companies in my past life, it's always the two that come together, the CEO and the CFO. And the relationship between the two can vary dramatically, from CEOs that are very financially adept and can talk about all their financials and their forecasts, et cetera, to ones that are, as you suggested, that are not quite as strong in the financial arena, and they really rely on their CFO to provide the outlook and the budgeting and whatnot. So there really is no particular rule of thumb in terms of how strong a CEO should be, but they definitely work together in concert, and they are very complementary in multiple ways. CEOs tend to be much more strategic in nature, whereas they can then rely on the CFOs for allocating capital where it's going to drive the highest return for shareholders. And so when you can marry that strategy together with a real robust financial review of the company, then you have a perfect storm, so to speak, where the two can come together and provide a really powerful decisions in driving the strategic decisions of the company. What I've seen in my past is CEOs that at least know the key metrics of the company and the key drivers. And these are things that we would work with companies to help them decide what they are. We call them the key performance indicators. There's leading and lagging indicators, things that you need to do to build your business. And then there's lagging indicators, which show you the results. And being able to track those on a consistent basis, monitoring them is best practice, at least on a weekly basis, building out your quarterly reports. Again, that's best practice to be able to build out your quarterly reports. That's what public companies do. Highly encourage private companies to do the same and get into a routine and procedure where you have a discipline to constantly monitor your financial performance, because without so, you're really just running blind. So a CEO needs to be aware of the numbers. CFO can help deliver those numbers, and together they can really help drive the business forward.
I'd love it if you could share one or two examples of companies that you've worked with where they did have financial models and how they benefited from it, like decisions that they were able to make because they had clarity into the financial side of the business, or perhaps an instance where they didn't have the data that they should have had and they made a bad decision.
I can give you two very good examples, and both on different ends of the spectrum. On one of them, it was really this company. It was a business outsourcing business, high recurring revenue, fast growing, very profitable, leader in its field, has very meaningful revenues in the hundreds of millions of dollars. And it had aggressive growth plans to go into new geographies. But there were two problems with the company. Number one, it had extremely high churn, meaning they lost a lot of customers. So it cost them dearly to acquire new customers. And as a result, their cash balance was declining, despite the fact that all the other metrics were looking great. Their cost of customer acquisition overall for the company was relatively low. The lifetime value of their customers was quite high, so that ratio of CAC to LTV was quite good. But there was something going wrong with the company where they were really struggling to maintain and grow their cash balance, and they're at severe risk of running out of cash. They already had a significant amount of debt, and the opportunity to fund that growth with more debt was not available to them. So they really had to hit the pause button to figure out what was going on. What we found interesting about it all was, after doing extensive due diligence and a real deep dive, took several months, a number of meetings with management, face-to-face and on-call, they set up a data room, and we went through no shortage of information. But it was one of those situations where it was more like analysis paralysis, where they had so much information, they couldn't really figure out what to do with it, and they weren't really analyzing the numbers. So what we finally figured out after all of this was two big conclusions. Number one was their largest clients had the best KPIs. So no surprise there, they provided the best lifetime value in terms of revenue, and they're the lowest cost to acquire because they stuck with the company for the longest. So they generated tremendous returns. The problem was their smallest clients, of which represented the majority of their thousands of clients and about one third of their revenue. But the problem was these small clients churned very quickly in the matter of months. And so that was a real problem because the cost to acquire these customers is very expensive. And so the next step of the analysis then became, you know, what do we do now that we've learned this? And why is this happening? And what are the steps we can take to remedy it Do we kill this part of the market and just completely eliminate the smaller clients that don't provide a meaningful return? Or do we change our strategy and provide a different level of service offering, et cetera? Or do we approach the market in a different way? So ultimately what happened was, upon our financial review, that ultimately drove a very big shift in their strategy for how they ran their business. And it addressed the biggest problem of churn with the company. It really highlights the fact that sometimes you need an independent review of a company to really understand what is going on. They had done a great job managing and growing the business over decades. They just ran into a problem and they literally could not see the forest for the trees. And we were able to help the company identify the problem and then solve the problem.
You point out a number of interesting things there, one of which is that companies can grow broke, meaning that they're growing so fast that the cash is leaking out the door. And in this case, you said that they had the high churn. And ultimately, after all of your analysis, you discovered that it was really the smaller clients that were the high churn. And so even though the top line looked really good, fast growth, they were running out of cash. And then a second point that came out of what you just described there is really understanding the profitability by client size, or it could be profitability by channel or by geography or how they were acquired, different things like that. So tell me a little bit more about how the financial model might dig into that level of detail, depending on the kind of company or the types of products or services that you're offering.
It really comes down to the segmented data that the company will provide. And every company I've ever dealt with has been tremendously different in how they represent their data. Some have great data repositories, others not so great. And it can really vary from, do they break out their customers by region, by product segment, by revenue, by gross margin, you name it. I've seen all the above. And my take on all of it is, whenever I begin a relationship with a company, the first question is, what kind of information do you need, Dan, to do your analysis? My simple answer is always, give me absolutely everything you have, because I need to see it all. And I need to look, review all the numbers that they have to really understand what they are missing and potentially see any patterns that may be problematic for them in terms of what is holding back their business model or consuming their cash or what have you. The net of it is, to answer your question, is we need to do a complete due diligence from top to bottom to be able to really make that assessment at the end of the day.
You've used the term data room and data repository. So if you were giving advice to a company that says, hey, I want to get this right starting today, meaning I want to make sure that I am gathering my financial data in the right way, I'm storing it in the right way and in the right place that's easily accessible, that can be sliced and diced in 1,000 different ways to make sure that we can put that model together and have it readily available in real time.
So we put together a template for best practices in terms of what companies should do to build a data room. And we don't necessarily need to think about a data room as a necessity when you are looking to sell the company or acquire companies or go public. We believe it's just a generally best practice to have this type of information at hand. We built out a template that puts together all the various drivers, financial reports, profiles, you name it, that helps drive company performance and help drive company value. And it goes from being a full model that we can help build out that we had talked about earlier, to ranking your senior leadership team, to listing the competitive advantages that the firm has, building a full cap table to really understand your shareholders and how they fit into the whole equation, and how your company is valued, not only in your industry, but across industries, and what potential target cos would look like in terms of if you wanted to embark on an M&A strategy. So we've done this, and we believe that this is a great starting point for companies to have that kind of discipline to put all these types of metrics together. And that's the program that we have been working with a number of companies to be able to help them put in the disciplines today to start thinking about what they can do to provide investors and their shareholders and or potentially new investors down the road, or companies always need access to capital. So if you are organized and have all this information at hand, it makes going to the market buying companies, et cetera, much, much easier. The other company that I had worked with was looking to complement their growth with an inorganic growth strategy. They're a technology company, a leader in their field, one of the top three or four players in North America. And similar to the last company, quite large, over $100 million in revenue. So my mandate was to really assist them in finding these targets, valuing these targets, and ensuring that they can consummate accretive acquisitions. And so the strategy was threefold. Number one, just buy market share, so buy your competitors. Two, vertically integrate, because it seemed that the market was shifting and being just a singular type company proved to be very relevant going forward. So they needed to both vertically integrate up the food chain and down the food chain. And thirdly, potentially diversify into new complementary businesses to really help provide a more robust platform. Fast forward several years into this engagement, and we had acquired two transformative companies in complementary business units. And we started being down the path of reviewing literally dozens of others of candidates, all showing tremendous promise in any one of those three categories. But then the management team and shareholders put a complete halt to the M&A strategy. And despite the fact that there was alignment on a strategy, or at least I thought there was concern in two areas. Number one, the company was becoming comfortable and complacent with their technology and ignored the shift in vertical integration. So they felt we're doing well today, we're growing fast enough, and our margins are great. So let's not mess with a good thing. And number two was they were afraid of dilution. And so future acquisitions became a riskier play in their mind. So they decided to not engage on an M&A opportunity. So they put everything on hold and they've been struggling ever since. The lesson here is number one, we really need to get all stakeholders to fully commit to a strategy. And not just from the get-go, but that's an ongoing process. And reviewing that strategy, ensuring that we are delivering on the strategy and delivering on the returns that are expected by shareholders and management, that's absolutely critical. And number two, and I'll quote my father, he used to say this all the time to me, change is the only constant in life. So this is a company that failed to embrace this change. And because of it, it fell, in my opinion, into a far riskier category of doing nothing, because sticking with the status quo, they became disintermediated and it was a real problem for them. So if you can embark on a strategy that is well thought out, that is executed well and generates returns and is in fact non-dilutive because you're buying companies accretively, then it really provides a very robust growth path for a company if it's executed properly.
One of the other things that struck me as you were telling that example there of that company is leaders have to watch out for is just complacency. And I remember Andy Grove, the former CEO of Intel, his comment that only the paranoid survive. I believe that was the name of one of his books. And I think that is such good advice that if you want to be a high-performing, thriving CEO, as well as have a company that does that too, you got to be a little bit paranoid and you can't be complacent and you can't let the technology pass you by, because if we're not changing faster than the world is, we're going to be falling behind at an accelerating pace.
I can't tell you how many times we've had conversations with companies where we are funding their growth with external capital from investors and or looking at an M&A strategy. And ultimately, companies that could see through the weeds recognize the fact that they would much rather have a smaller piece of a growing and large pie versus owning everything of a shrinking to a declining pie that goes to zero. And the companies that tend to do the latter are very inwardly focused, and it's unfortunate. Where they think they are, in fact, trying to take on less risk, it often spells their demise.
Have you ever run across any situations where a high focus on the money has actually caused a problem for the company?
Throughout my entire career, whenever we raised capital for companies, our single mantra, which still I think it holds true today, is you take as much money as you can whenever you can from investors when they are prepared to write checks. Companies always push back that they don't want to suffer dilution and they don't need that kind of capital. But the markets are very cyclical. The capital that is freely available today may not be freely available tomorrow. So you always take more capital than you realize that you need, because business plans always go sideways. forecasts almost never are attained, at least based on my experience. So you always want to have more than enough cash to provide that buffer. So to answer your question, what I would suggest to any company, because it's always tough to run your business when you're running super lean, because then you have to really make sacrifices to be able to manage your cash, is take as much cash as you can, conserve the cash that you build in your balance sheet as aggressively as possible, put it in a safe place and have a nice buffer for when things aren't going as well.
We've been talking about some of the financial models, and you gave a couple good examples here of companies that you've worked with. What about on the compensation side? Because obviously money changes hands as people get compensated. How do you think about compensation models? Do you have any examples, either good or bad situations related to that?
I do. And if I take a page from my previous life in investment banking, which I did for 25 years, I joined a small outfit. And the reason I joined a small outfit midway through my career was I knew the handful of partners that had built this firm. They're all very smart and very credible people. And the most successful investment banks in the world, at least on the boutique side, always had a recipe for success. And that was starting with a core nucleus of very solid, smart people who worked well together. So over my tenure, this company grew at least 10x in revenue and probably 20x in profitability. And we became the number one boutique, investment boutique in technology and mining in Canada. It was tremendous in terms of what we were doing to both grow the business, the effect that we're having on clients and institutional investors that were investing their money. So my job as a head of research and as an analyst was to hand out bonus checks. We did that every quarter as cash came in, cash went out the door. Compensation was the biggest component of our overhead, as it is for a lot of companies. And what was really surprising to me was when we were small, the bonus checks were relatively small. It was all well and good, very collegial. We all worked together as a team and there was a lot of camaraderie. But as the firm continued to grow and the bonus checks were growing 50 to 100% per year, what was most shocking to me was the angst and the anger and the dissatisfaction grew, and it grew directly proportional to the increase in check size. And everyone was making more than they deserved because we were so profitable. However, culture was lost, friendships were strained, and it was no longer fun to come into the office because it became so hyper-competitive. And so it was a really powerful lesson to me that, number one, this company should have retained more capital when it could. So we're talking about cash and compensation. When times are good in the stock market, they can be very good. But when they're bad, they can be extremely bad. And you have to prepare for the downturn. Preserving cash is absolutely paramount. And number two, what was ironic to me was, on the one hand, it was the hubris of people that caused this problem, because it was the relative gains or value that they held within the firm that caused the problem and the angst that I talked about earlier. On the other hand, you need the hubris of people to be successful in investment banking. You need a bit of a chip on your shoulder and an attitude and think that you are, in fact, better than everyone else to be able to succeed in this industry because it is so cutthroat. So it was a tipping of a balance, so to speak. On the one hand, when we were small, everything was good. Everything was in balance. And you can become too successful or you can become, or the flip side of it, neither scenario is good when things go out of balance.
And you're really highlighting one of the reasons why it can be so difficult to be a great leader is because you've got to strike the right balance between competing tensions, as you just described here. And one thing that we haven't really touched on much today, and we've got other podcasts where we have talked about this, which is the culture. And oftentimes, if you've got a certain type of culture, it's going to help you strike the right balance. But culture doesn't just happen overnight, of course, and leadership certainly plays a key role in shaping that culture as well.
Compensation tends to drive, especially in investment banking, a big part of your culture. It determines if you are working in a collegial atmosphere and going towards a common goal versus having a cutthroat, very protectionist, this is my book of business and therefore I'm entitled to X, Y, Z commissions versus everyone else. And when I reflect back on my experience there, that company had lost sight of its goals and lost its culture. And the biggest thing about my attraction to that firm and why I stuck with them for so long was it was a tremendously fun place to work. And by that, what I mean is, in Canada, we don't have a well-defined private equity market like there is in the United States. So a lot of companies have to go public far too early in their life stream to be able to access capital. And so we acted like venture capitalists in many ways. And we funded companies that were from pre-revenue up to billions of dollars in revenue. But the real reason why we did that was for job creation and wealth creation for both them and for our investors. So providing that capital to see these companies grow, to invest in new people and new products and in buying other companies, et cetera, was a very satisfying and rewarding thing to do, to be able to drive that type of economic engine in Canada. And we lost sight of that. And because we became too successful, money literally got in the way of our culture. And so that was a powerful lesson to me, that we should have been more proactive in reminding our constituents, our employees, et cetera, that is the overriding goal, and that money should not be the primary force or the reason why you come into the office.
Very well said there, Dan. I appreciate that. So let's just wrap up with a couple quick things here. So one is, you've touched on this a little bit in terms of CEO coaching and the tools and resources that you have available on the financial modeling side. So tell me a little bit more about that, if you could. And then I'd love for you to wrap up with any final thought or two that you have to put a bow on the conversation today.
I'm just going to summarize it relatively quickly, because we're going to be launching this formal program, multiple programs in short order here. Suffice to say, we broke it out into multiple buckets. And from the starting point, we would assess a company's current state and take a look at their existing financial practices. Oftentimes, we see companies that don't really have any reporting capabilities. They are literally running their business using their bank statements. So we would help them build out their financial models, be it in QuickBooks and or Excel, build out those core financial statements that we had talked about, make sure that they're on an accrual basis. A lot of companies are running on a cash basis, so that you need accrual accounting to really be able to be more strategic in terms of knowing where your business is so you can match your expenses, et cetera. And then build out custom dashboards. On the other end of the spectrum, we would help companies on the M&A side, help them raise capital, build out this data room, really build out their capabilities from even non-financial areas, things such as PowerPoint decks, investor decks, one-pagers, you name it, building out quarterly reports. All that kind of discipline we think is absolutely paramount to really drive the discipline and the best practices required by investors. In terms of final thoughts, three things I'd like to leave you with is, number one, know your numbers. As a business, if you don't know your numbers, there's absolutely no way you can properly manage your business. So that's where I always start. And I would highly encourage every company that we deal with to have a solid handle on their numbers. Number two is manage your cash. That is the number one priority, as I said before, for CEO and CFO. Absolutely paramount to be able to know where your cash is going, how it's being consumed, and where you expect it's going to be consumed based on your forecasts going forward. And lastly, and equally important to the other two points, is don't be greedy. And by that, what I mean is, if you are embarking on a growth strategy or looking to raise equity capital from outside investors, you need to accept dilution. And if it makes your company strategically stronger and more robust, then that is the smart decision for the company.
That's a great place to wrap up, Dan. Appreciate you being on the show today. And for those of you listening here, you can get more information by going to CEOcoachinginternational.com. Thanks for listening to the podcast. Now, I have a question for you. How are you going to implement and benefit from the ideas that you hear on our show? Well, we would love to have a conversation with you about that. So please visit us at CEOcoachinginternational.com. We can then set up a call, and we can talk about how we can help you make big happen in your business. Thanks, and we look forward to sharing our next episode with you.